American politics may never be the same. On To The Point, we help you understand the trends driving this wild and woolly election.
Donald Trump has had nothing but wonderful things to say about all variety of dictators and thugs around the world.
Our system of politics right now is so incredibly corrupt.
The sense of nostalgia for a kind of lost cultural world and real anxiety about its passing, I think, is fueling, you know, much of what we're seeing.
I'm Armin Alney. Stay with To The Point through November and beyond on KCRW and KCRW.com.
Welcome to Sheer Intelligence. This is Robert Sheer, and my guest today, and it's the guest that supplies the intelligence, is Mike Farrell. And for those who are too young to remember when he was the star on MASH for, what was it, about 6 years?
Eight years.
Everyone in the country knew who Mike Farrell was. But he's had a long, distinguished career as an actor, and he actually has been a leader in the Screen Actors Guild, much like Ronald Reagan was. Only as opposed to Reagan, Mike Farrell has chosen to use his celebrity as an actor to support progressive causes, and actually not just progressive causes that are basic to the whole human condition. He was, for 10 years, a leader and is still very active in human rights organization, Human Rights Watch.
Correct.
And which is probably, you know, along right up there with Amnesty International. Those are the two major organizations that one looks to for a consistent and honest view of human rights around the world. And then he took on another cause, which is really quite difficult in terms of political acceptance, and that has to do with the death penalty in particular and the administration of justice in the prison system in general and its death penalty focus. And this is an issue where, you know, a lot of people think, okay, yeah, let's be for it, but, you know, they did terrible crimes and blah, blah, blah. And it's not one of those obvious do-gooder issues. Maybe this is, would be a good place to start. Why death penalty focus? Why this issue that has absorbed so much of your time?
When I was in my 20s, I was involved with a halfway house organization. Had junkies and alcoholics and people with what were then called sexually perverted, fixations. And I learned a lot from them. And one of the things we did once we sort of got through the rudiments of it was to go into prisons and take the program in there. And because this was a not an unusual program, I guess, but it was run by reforming addicts, alcoholics, etc., people who'd been in and out of prisons, mental institutions. They were the people that ran it. They were the people that set it up. They were quite extraordinary. There was a wonderful psychologist and a couple social workers associated with it as well. And they taught a fundamental lesson that all any human being wants are three things: love, attention, and respect. And that really rang true to me, because I was hurting when I got there initially. But when we worked through that, and when I saw the sort of, what do they say in the Bible, the scales fall from the eyes, when I saw people lose the masks, when I saw people being reborn, essentially, really coming to an understanding of their own value. And we took that into prisons, and we talked about it, and I saw the horror of prisons, the sort of soul-deadening aspect of prisons. So none of that made any sense to me. Then when I got lucky enough to be successful as an actor, and I got involved in, you know, the anti-war stuff and gay rights movement, and there was always this thing eating at me about the death penalty, because that was, to me, the sort of bottom line. That was the anti-life, by definition, position. We didn't use it much in the 40s and 50s, in or the 60s. In 72, it was held unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. In 76, when I was doing MASH, it was reinstated. And a minister contacted me, a guy from Nashville contacted me and said, I understand you're against the death penalty. I had written that or signed a petition or something. And I said, yeah, I am. And he said, I think we're heading for a bloodbath in this country. And I need help from somebody who can get media attention. Would you help me? And I said, yeah. And that started it. He took me to my first death row in Tennessee. And it's a little like quicksand. Once you step into it, you can't get out. It keeps sucking you in.
Well, it's a moral quicksand. It's interesting. Let me just start with your own beginning. You said you were at a halfway house, and this was when you were 20? Or
in my 20s, yeah.
And you weren't as a patient? You were a volunteer? Or?
No, I was in as a member. I grew up in West Hollywood, and I lived in a Catholic household, Irish Catholic, with a volcanic father who terrified me. And I was a frightened child. I was just a scared kid, you know, dancing as fast as I could to kind of keep from people knowing how scared I was. And I grew up and graduated from high school. I joined the Marines to prove how tough I was. My father died when I was in high school. And
you were in Okinawa, actually.
I was, yeah.
I read about that.
So I got married at just doing what I was supposed to be doing, and then the marriage fell apart after 3 years. And I was floored. I was just shattered, and everything came apart for me. And this friend of mine who was involved in this place said, maybe you ought to go there, go to the house, as we called it.
Was it like Delancey Street?
It was similar, yeah. Didn't become a cult. No, Delancey Street, yes, yeah. Like Delancey Street.
Not like Synanon.
Not like Synanon, yeah, like the cult. Tough, you know, really hard, serious therapy. And these guys, I mean, you got into the mix, and these guys, many of them out of the gutter, some of them were, you know, on the verge of killing themselves or whatever. So the process was a tough one, but it just said, open up. Look at who you are. Take a long, hard look and see if you like what you see, and if you don't, what you want to do about it. And it was obviously a life-changing experience for me. I went into what we called the stupid group, stupid because we didn't know how to ask for what we wanted. And then when I learned some stuff there and challenged one of the people, I became what they called the responsible group. And the responsible people were the ones that went into prisons and tried to talk to people about the program and where to come, how to come out.
You mentioned pro-life and your Catholic background. I don't know to what degree you were influenced by religion, but, you know, one of the good points about the Catholic Church,
yes,
is that it's been quite consistent that opposition to the death penalty has to be part of a consistent pro-life position.
In recent years.
Well, I think even when you were growing up, I think Pope John, the first Pope John, who was quite progressive.
Great pope, yes.
Yes, a great pope. We now have another great pope. Yep. So the church has had its fine moments. But the reason I bring up that history is I recall, because I happened to be a graduate student in Berkeley in 1959, 60, mm-hmm. at that time when we had the Carol Chessman case.
Yeah.
And a bunch of us went up to Sacramento to try to get Pat Brown, the father of Jerry Brown, who was then governor, to look more carefully before the execution of Carol Chessman, who had not killed anyone.
Right.
And I remember Pat Brown coming out and talking to us, actually, and asking, where are you from? And we said, Berkeley, and said, yeah, well, that's not where the votes are, you know, that are going wrong. Now, he himself was a Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
His son, Jerry Brown, was a Jesuit scholar,
mm-hmm.
and actually went to his father and talked to him about being opposed to the death penalty. And Pat Brown may have destroyed his career. He was a very popular governor by delaying the execution of Carol Chessman. So I only bring that up because this was a really hot button issue that could destroy a politician. This was not a safe cause. Yet over the years, and thanks to people like you, I'm talking to Mike Farrell here, we've learned about the miscarriage of, quite apart from whether you think we have a right to kill people, the fact is one of the things about the death penalty is it ends all discussion, and then you can find out the person is innocent and there isn't anything you can do about it that would matter to that person. And I gathered the other night, the people I talked to who had been at your dinner, you did have, like, I think the number is 19.
I believe that's right, as
okay.
I recall.
And what did they say? What is the story here? 19 people who were innocent, and they've been cleared by some of these projects which we have now where you can do DNA testing. And so, but why don't you talk about that? Because that's a positive aspect of this work that you do.
Well, yeah. You know, when I first got started with Joe Engel, the minister from Nashville, I went into death row like everybody else, thinking these are child-eating, fang-toothed monsters, you know? And then I saw that they were mostly black and brown, they were mostly ignorant, they were frightened, they were just people, just like you and I, but they had done, in most instances, done a terrible thing. And as I said, that kind of sucks you in. So the more I got involved and the more I learned about it, the more I saw how politically involved this thing was. It was the political third rail. No politician after the Nixon Agnew years would say I was against the death penalty because they'd replace soft on communism with soft on crime. And you just see the horror of this thing. So we began to talk about the issue. I talked about it publicly. People then got together. I was asked to come to be part of Death Penalty Focus. Ultimately, I became the president of the board of Death Penalty Focus. What we did was educate. What we did was let people understand the reality of this thing, how much it costs, how many innocent people are entrapped, how many we have now today, 156, I think, actually now because of two things in Pennsylvania, 158 people who were tried, convicted, sentenced to death, spent years on death row, only to ultimately have been found to be innocent and exonerated and freed. What we don't know is how many who were innocent were killed.
How were they found to be innocent? Is it mostly be the new science of DNA testing?
Actually, DNA it results in about 15 to 20% of the exonerations. The rest is pure research, digging, caring students, law students, caring lawyers.
The Innocence
Sister Helen
Project.
Prejean. The Innocence Project primarily does its work through DNA. Yeah, but they've freed well over 300 people, but not all death row things. The death row freeing of death row people started with Kirk Bloodsworth in the I think early 90s.
I interrupted you when you were mentioning a sister.
Sister Helen Prejean. Dead Man Walking, the movie. So what we began to see was that as you could raise this level of understanding, Larry Marshall, who's now a professor at Stanford, ran something in Chicago called Center on Wrongful Convictions. We co-sponsored the first meeting at the Chicago Law School of people who were exonerated and freed from death row. At that time, there were 76 of them. And Larry was able to get 30-some of them to come and appear on stage. And we had press from all over the world there saying, these are people who've gone through our death row process, but were innocent. And they'd each stand up and say, if the state of California or the state of Illinois or the state of Texas had its way, I would be dead today. And it was really a marker, a historic marker, I think. Now, that was then. We had 76. Today, we've doubled that, more than doubled that. We have over 100, close to 160 now, probably. And this is just death row. This is not other people who are trapped in the system who didn't get the death penalty but got life without parole or got life sentence or got, the Frankie Carrillos of this world, a young man at 16 years old, spent 20 years here in California in prison, and is now a graduate of Loyola Marymount and just was granted $10 million by the Los Angeles County for wrongful conviction. What we did was educate people about the fact that this is, there's something terribly wrong.
It's interesting, and a negative commentary on American culture here. The show is about, in large measure, American originals, and there's something great about our culture, our claim to be a melting pot, our crazy quilt, and we do produce a lot of different things. But where we've been really weak from a enlightened angle is the question of crime, and particularly the death penalty. And in most of a large part of the world, the death penalty is now a closed issue.
That's right. Yeah, when I started, of the 190 nations that the UN recognizes, about 20-25 had given up the death penalty. Today, it's just the reverse. About 160 have given it up, and 30 continue it, and the United States is among the top five.
And we recognize that those that continue it are being barbaric.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's sure. A marker. You just say, oh, Saudi Arabia, marker. You know, right. China, that's one of the big, marker. Let me ask you about that, because, and I don't want to make this too political, but one of, I remember Christopher Hitchens, who was a brilliant journalist and a friend of mine, but I didn't agree with him on the Iraq War and so forth. I'm sure you had some disagreements. But there was something he did that really has never left me. He described Bill Clinton's involvement with the death penalty during his first campaign for president. Why don't you tell us about that case? Because that, to my mind, okay, we have an enlightened politician, progressive, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And yet here was somebody who was severely diminished capacity. And as I recall, he didn't even, he thanked them for giving him his last dessert or meal because he had no idea he was going to be killed. He
actually, Ricky Rector was a black man who murdered somebody and was arrested. The policeman came to the door and said, "You're under arrest." And he had a gun and he put it to his own head and fired, damaged his brain, didn't kill himself. So they tried, convicted, and sentenced him to death. Ricky had no conscious understanding of the situation in which he found himself. And in February of, what would that have been, 92, when Clinton was in, and this was in Arkansas, so Clinton was the governor of Arkansas campaigning for the presidency, he left his race. He left the New Hampshire campaign to come to Arkansas to preside over the execution of Ricky Ray Rector to show how tough he was on crime, obviously. Ricky Ray Rector was given his final meal, and he took the pie that was left for his dessert. He said, "Well, I'll put that aside for when I come back." When I come back from the execution chamber. He had no idea that he was going to die.
And the thing about Human Rights Watch and death penalty folks and Amnesty International is you're going, and the ACLU, you're going to be defending people who may be reprehensible but still have rights.
Yes.
Still have soul. Yeah. And the causes are not going to always be popular, and the people that are doing the bad things in terms of government and so forth can otherwise present as reasonable and enlightened. Mm-hmm. And so I was just wondering, with this death penalty focus, what kind of a road has it been in terms of trying to win over the community?
A tough one, a very hard road. We used to have meetings in rooms this size. You couldn't.
Just for people listening, we're in a very small studio at KCRW in Santa Monica, and I don't think you could fit five more people in here.
There was a period in the, well, it would have been the 90s, where we were $13,000 in debt. And it was seven of us sitting around a room and a few people in Northern California sitting around a room trying to figure out, can we continue? And we decided we would. We'd figure it out. We'd pay the franchise and we'd do it. We went up to San Francisco and we made common cause with the people up there. And we kept it going and we kept educating and we kept trying to get people to understand. And then we had our first fundraising dinner in a basement of a church somewhere. And then I figured if we could get a celebrity, somebody that the public's attention would be gathered by.
You weren't a big enough celebrity at that point?
No.
Well, I mean, people should be reminded you were at the top of celebritydom at one point, right?
Certainly.
When you played a surgeon on MASH, right? And I mean, yeah, but well, go on.
But it wasn't, you know.
Not big enough.
It wasn't me. Yeah. I'm not, it wasn't about me. Yeah. But we could do it at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, and it would give some credibility to the organization and the issue. And we did that. And then we had a few there. We had them at Fairmont, and then we at the Beverly Hilton.
You mentioned some of the people you had because they deserve some credit.
Oh, well, we've honored Senator Russ Feingold. We've honored Mrs. Carter, Rosalynn Carter. We've honored Jesse Jackson. We've honored Danny Glover and Martin Sheen and the people from the West Wing. We honored the show. Because we figured if we can get that kind of attention to the issue and people who were willing to accept the honor from it.
You know, you came from a rough background and we sort of dropped the narrative there. You're in a halfway house. You're struggling mm-hmm. with your own issues. This is before you went into the Marine Corps? Or?
No, it was after.
After the Marine yeah. Corps. So there you are. And what, 20-something?
25.
25, ex-Marine, halfway house, yeah. and so forth. And how did you decide you're going to be an actor, and how did it work?
I wanted to be an actor from the time I was a kid. I was raised in West Hollywood, and my sister, I had an older sister, who brought movie magazines home. And I saw that young people were movie stars, and they got all the things I wanted. I wanted that attention. I wanted that affection. I wanted that love, I didn't understand it in those terms. I just was attracted to it. So being an actor was something I dreamed about. And being raised, it's a little like, you grow up in the lumber town, you go to work in the mill. I thought being an actor is possible.
Well, you were at Hollywood High, right?
I was at Hollywood High, yeah. But, of course, my dad, being who he was, would have lacerated me from, would have been Katie bar the door, an actor. So after he passed away and I graduated from high school, I went in the Marines. And after I got out, I decided I wanted to try to pursue this career, but I didn't have any idea what I was doing. And I remember sitting in a gas station with a friend of mine, another ex-Marine, and we were talking about life. And he had a guy working with him was from Canada who had come all the way from Eastern Canada to Los Angeles to become an actor. And I said, well, geez, I wanted to be an actor, too. He said, well, maybe you ought to do something about it. And I said, what do you do? And he was at an actor's workshop, and he said, come on down. And I was scared to death, but I thought, okay. So you start out, You begin to understand the craft. You begin to work your way up. You meet some people. You get in a play. You have an agent that says, you have an interesting type. And then I got married, and then I had to move to Orange County because that's where my wife was a teacher, and that kind of put the acting on a hold. And then I said, no, I've really got to give this a try. So I spent more time away from home than I was at home, and then the marriage fell apart. So.
But you've had another marriage to an actress that has been very very important to your...
Indeed, a very different kind of situation. I'm married to Shelley Fabre, the fabulous Shelley Fabre, who I met actually initially when I was working as an actor in a series, but we just met. She was married, I was married. That was all there was to it. And 12 years later, we met again.
She actually had quite a career.
Too. Oh, she did have a fabulous career.
I think she might have even been more famous than you were.
Johnny Angel.
And so that is interesting in terms of, that you've had a real life. We don't think that celebrities, and certainly not actors, there used to be a whole thing that actors weren't very smart.
Oh, yes.
And that goes back. In fact, Tim Robbins, who did Men Walking and the Actors Gang, had a play about that with kind of a commedia dell'arte,
really?
Which the whole thing about whether actors have brains. And not that I went to, I think it was just last month. And then I thought, but here's Tim Robinson, certainly shown you can have a great deal of awareness of your society, big brain,
indeed.
And so forth. How should we think of actors these days? I mean, the industry has changed. It used to be you know, as Ronald Reagan famously described it, if you worked for the studio, you worked for Warner Brothers, they not only told you what to think and what to say, they told you who to date and who to marry and how to dress. And now it's a much more fragmented world. But can people speak up? Is there intellectual freedom? What are the pressures?
Well, I think the pressures are immense. If you get into a certain level of fame and a certain level, therefore, of money-making capacity for the people around you, actors continue, I think, to be the royalty of our society. I think celebrity is taking a heavy shot because of reality TV and the rise of Mr. Trump. I think people are becoming a little more leery of the assuming that being a celebrated individual means you have some gravitas.
Yeah, there's such a thing as bad publicity.
Yeah. But within the industry, if you begin to have success, there are those things. There are some not only smart enough, but caring enough, thoughtful enough to involve themselves in really meaningful issues. But most of the time, the people in the position of significance in the industry are warned away from involving themselves with things that are controversial because it could cost them. It can cost them money in terms of the amount of money they'll be paid for a film or a television series, or it can cost them popularity.
Did you experience that kind of pressure?
No. Ed Asner says that there's a gray list that, you know, no longer the black list, but a gray list that some of us are on. I've never had any sense that that was true. I've had some disagreements with people about things and been open about it. I don't have any personal experience of having somebody say to me, I'm never going to work with you.
You're never going to work in this town.
Yeah.
But let me ask you about the one thing that has happened is as we got a more diverse population of not only actors but producers, directors, and so forth. One of the big payoffs of diversity is you suddenly have a group of people who might assert concerns about problems in the society that the larger society would like to ignore. And it doesn't always work that when we know famously, again, that in Hollywood, even though there was prominent Jewish ownership and presence, Jewish actors were told to change their noses and their names, and and Hollywood didn't discuss, the emerging Holocaust and what had happened until quite late in the day against Jews. And so it's not automatic. But I would say one issue that has really changed dramatically because of that is the gay issue.
Yes.
Which you mentioned. I mean, I have not seen any issue where there's been such rapid progress.
Yeah, it is amazing.
And part of that has to do with people in Hollywood coming out of the closet and saying, look, you know, we're going to have, if you're going to have a reality show, you're going to have a gay guy on it and so forth, a gay woman. But the issue, and getting back to the issues that you've cared about, human rights in general, and not that gay rights aren't human rights, and the death penalty, this requires a different sensitivity, which almost requires going back to your Catholic background, invoking some notion of Jesus and the other and the Good Samaritan or something. I mean, that everyone has a soul.
Oh, indeed.
And that you have had, in terms of your work on death penalty focus, have had to remind us that even people charged with the worst crimes, most insensitive, anti-human crimes, have a soul, have complexity, and, in fact, may be wrongly accused.
Absolutely. Yeah, there are four hypotheses I put out, which are that every human being has intrinsic value, no matter what he or she does. No one is only the worst thing he or she has ever done. There is always a reason for human behavior. And the state killing lowers the entire community to the level of its least member at his or her worst moment. I mean, we just have to understand that it's not like there is some other out there who does terrible things. That this bad seed notion makes me ill, that people behave sometimes terribly, but if you look at the background, you understand that there's a reason for their behaving terribly, and that there's a reason that society fails to not recognize how to deal with the the circumstances of these lives rather than simply terminating the individual because of his or her inability to behave in what we deem to be an appropriate manner.
That's a good place to end this. This is Robert Scheer. I've been talking to Mike Farrell, and I must say I've been around this Hollywood scene for a long time. I worked for the LA Times for 29 years. I got to know a lot of people. And I have long regarded you with incredible respect. I mean, you're not showy. You don't, you're not adding it for your career. You don't exploit it for any kind of big personal reason. You just work these issues. And it is really that workmanlike attitude of getting the facts, finding out what these cases are about, getting support, trying to educate the community. You really have become a really important public intellectual. So I want to take this moment to thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
And that's it for Scheer Intelligence. My producers are Joshua Scheer and Rebecca Mooney, and my engineer today has been Mario Diaz. And we taped here at KCRW in Santa Monica. See you next week. Sacamos